Let's look at Daniel chapter 7. Well, this is where things get hard in Daniel. We've talked about the first six chapters of the book of Daniel, and those are easy passages to preach about. You got Daniel refusing to eat the king's food in chapter 1. You got Nebuchadnezzar's image that he has in a dream, and Daniel's explanation of that image, and the stone that crushes the image in Daniel chapter 2. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The sort of the dehumanization of Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4 when he's reduced to the status of an animal for a period of time. You got Daniel in the lion's den and Belshazzar's feast. All of that, those are easy passages to preach on. But beginning in Daniel chapter 7, things get much more difficult. You don't have as much of a story in these particular chapters. And you have predictions of what are going to take, things that are going to take place in the future. And so these passages from chapter 7 to the end of the book are a little bit more difficult for us to study and to understand and teach and preach about, but we'll do our best. And what we've been trying to do in our Sunday morning or Sunday evening sermons over a period of time is just follow our readings. And you may have noticed that we read in Daniel chapter 7 this morning. We'll complete that reading tonight. And so the sermon this morning is on that passage. And we began doing that in Daniel chapter 1. And I have to admit, for a period of time, I thought, well, I'll just end that after chapter 6. But several have asked me, well, I've really enjoyed the sermons on Daniel. Are you going to keep going after chapter 6? And I thought, well, I guess I'll do my best. I guess I'll try to do that. And so don't be intimidated by those comments. Even though the material is a little bit more difficult, with some effort, with some work, some concentration, some study, we can get a pretty good handle on the things he's talking about. And we may not be able to specifically identify every detail, but we can get the gist of what he's saying, and we can get a pretty firm grasp and a pretty good understanding of the things Daniel talks about in chapter 7 through the end of the book. It's sort of like a puzzle when you read a passage like Daniel chapter 7. And so we're looking for the clues that will help us solve the puzzle or solve the riddle. And so we take what he says and we draw on the information that we've learned from the book of Daniel. We draw on the information that we've learned in the rest of the Bible. We draw on a little information that we know from history outside the Bible. And then take all of that together and apply it to Daniel chapter 7 and similar passages. And that kind of study, a close study, will reveal the meaning of this and other passages. And so let's just talk, first of all, about the content of Daniel 7. Daniel sees a vision. And in this vision, he sees four beasts. There's one that's like a lion, and we have a little bit of a description of that in chapter 4. He has wings like an eagle, and he looked until the wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a human mind or human heart was given to him. And so the first one's like a lion, and you get a little bit of a description of that in verse 4. The second one is like a leopard, and you get a little description of that. And then the third one, the second one's like a bear, and then the third one is like a leopard. Leopard has wings on its back and things like that. And so you get a description of that in verse 6. Had four heads and dominion was given to it. And then there's a fourth beast. And the fourth beast is different from the other beasts. We learn a little bit later that it has iron teeth and it has claws and things like that. But Daniel sees it and it's different from the other beasts. Verse 7. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong, and had large iron teeth. Now, remember that, iron teeth. Now, where have we come across that idea of something made of iron before? Well, you remember in Daniel chapter 2, in this statue that Nebuchadnezzar saw in a dream, the legs of the statue were made of iron. Remember, just keep that in mind. So this has iron teeth. That statue had iron legs. And so we can make a connection between those two. But it had large iron teeth, and it devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder, that is the other beast, with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And so this fourth beast, that's, it's not like a lion or a bear or a leopard. It's different. Although it has claws, it has teeth, it has feet. Still, in many ways, it's different. And it tramples down the other ones. It has 10 horns. And so now Daniel is focused on the 10 horns. And then he's looking and a little horn comes up among the 10. Verse 8. While I was contemplating the horns, another horn, a little one, came up among them. And three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great boasts. And so you see his attention is focused in a more and more narrow way. Four beasts at first. Then his focus is on the fourth beast. And then he sees that this fourth beast has 10 horns. And then he sees one horn and it begins very small. It uproots three of the horns. And then later on, Daniel will say its appearance was very large. And so it seems as though it's growing and growing and growing, even to the point of uprooting some of the other horns. It's given a mouth, or it has a mouth, and it has eyes. This horn, so just imagine that. A horn, it's got eyes. And it has a mouth, and it's speaking. And it's boasting great things, or making great boasts. You see that there at the end of verse 8. Well, eventually, verses 11 and 12 tell us that the beast is killed. It's destroyed. Its body is given to the burning fire. And so finally, this fourth beast is destroyed and its body is burned. Now, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves there, because in between Daniel's vision of the fourth beast and the 10 horns and the one little horn and the time that this beast is killed and destroyed and his body is burned, he sees the Ancient of Days. And so look at that, verses 9 and 10. Thrones were set up. The Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow, the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze in flames. His wheels were a burning fire. A river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him, and thousands upon thousands were attending him, and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat and the books were open. So the Ancient of Days, which denotes eternity, this one who is from eternity, the Ancient of Days, he's sitting on a throne. And thousands upon thousands are attending to him. The books are open, and so he's in a position of authority. And as a judge, he'll open the books and he'll judge according to the things that are written in the books. And so his hair is white, his vesture is white. Indication of purity and holiness. And so there's really no question. We don't have to be Solomon to figure out who's being described here. This is God Almighty, isn't it? God who sits on the throne, who is eternal, who is sinless and pure and only light, who has authority and who is attended by thousands upon thousands upon thousands. And so you got the beast with the 10 horns and the one little horn coming up. And then you have the establishment of God on the throne. When I say establishment, I mean Daniel in his vision sees that. The Ancient of Days sitting on the throne. Then the beast is destroyed and killed and his body is burned with fire. The next thing that he sees in verse 13 is one like a son of man. Verse 13. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming. He came up to the Ancient of Days. Remember, he's sitting on the throne. And so the one like a son of man comes to the Ancient of Days, was presented before him, and to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. That is, serve the son of man, or the one like a son of man. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will never be destroyed. And so he approached the Ancient of Days, and a kingdom, an everlasting dominion was given to him. Well, that's the vision. Daniel is troubled by it. He doesn't really understand, at least in detail, he doesn't understand what the vision is meant to convey, the message of the vision. And so, verse 15, he talks about that. My mind was alarming me. My spirit was distressed within me. I approached one of those who were standing by and began asking him the exact meaning of all this. Can you tell me what all of this means? And so he's given a rather general explanation. It's not a detailed explanation at first, it's just a general explanation. Verse 17, these great beasts are four in number, and are four kings who will arise from the earth. And so the four beasts that he sees, the lion, the bear, the leopard, the fourth one that's different from the rest of them, he's told these represent four kings, or later on they'll be called four kingdoms. So the king represents the kingdom over which he reigns. And so the four beasts are four kingdoms. And then he goes on with this rather general explanation to say in verse 17, or verse 18, the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come. So remember, the Son of Man went to the Ancient of Days and received a kingdom. And now Daniel is told that the saints, along with the Son of Man, whom the Son of Man represents, the Son of Man and his people, they receive the kingdom and the dominion forever and ever in all ages to come. So that's a general explanation as to the meaning of the vision. Okay, we can grasp that. That's not all that difficult to understand. But Daniel's not really satisfied with that. He wants to know more. He wants to know more of the details. And so he says in verse 19, I desire to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its claws of bronze, which devoured, crushed, and trampled down the remainder with its feet. I wanted to know the meaning of the ten horns. I wanted to know the meaning of the little horn. And verse 20 says, which was larger in appearance than its associates. I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them. And the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the highest one. And the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. And so I want to know more about all this. I want to know more about that fourth beast. Now, you've told me that the four beasts represent four kingdoms, but can you tell me more about that fourth beast and the ten horns and the little horn and all of those deep? Can you tell me more about that? Well, he's told, beginning in verse 23 down through verse 27, which really constitute the thrust of the main thrust of the passage here. This is where the real detail of the passage is given. And it's the most difficult part of the passage as well. But he's told that the fourth beast is a fourth kingdom. Verse 23, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms and will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. And then he's told that the ten horns are ten kings. As for the ten horns out of this kingdom, ten kings will arise. And then you remember that little horn that came up, and another will arise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones, and he will subdue three kings. And so this little horn, he's going to be another king, and he's going to come up, very violent king, going to subdue three kings, and then he's going to do four other things. Look at verse 25. He'll speak out against the Most High. Remember, he is uttering great boasts. And so these are boasts of blasphemy. Accusations against God, railing against God. He will speak out against the Most High. He will wear down the saints of the highest one. Or some versions say he's going to wear them out. He's going to wear out the saints. He will intend to make alterations in times and in law. And so you can see the arrogance that he possesses. He wants to change the time. He wants to change the law. He wants to bring about just a large, wide-ranging, sweeping changes in the way that things work in the world. And then it says, they will be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. And so for a period of time, he's going to persecute the saints. He's going to wear out the saints. And they're going to be under his authority for a period of time. Time, times, and a half a time. Well, That's great, Daniel. That's a wonderful explanation. If I just could understand what it meant. So the explanation itself is not straightforward, is it? There are no names. I'd like for Daniel to say, now, this fourth beast, it's this empire. Yeah, call it by name, but he doesn't in this passage. There are no locations. There are no dates given. It's a general explanation at first. And then there's more detail given, but even in that detailed explanation, no names, no dates, no locations, that make it easy for us. And so we got to continue to dig and continue to study. And so let's see if we can give a good explanation of the explanation. Well, the four beasts are the four kingdoms. Well, what kingdoms are they? Well, we've come across this four kingdom theme before in the book of Daniel, haven't we? All the way back in Daniel chapter 2. Remember Daniel chapter 2? Nebuchadnezzar has a dream and dreams about this great image, this statue. The head was made of gold, and then the chest was made of silver, and then the loins bronze, and then legs iron. We've alluded to that earlier. Well, Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar that each part of this statue represents a kingdom. There are going to be four successive kingdoms, beginning with Babylon, beginning with Nebuchadnezzar. He says, you're the head of gold, but you're going to be followed by another kingdom. And then that will be followed by another one. Then that will be followed by a fourth kingdom. And in the days of that fourth kingdom, God's going to set up his kingdom, a kingdom that will never be destroyed. And remember, we suggested when we were studying that Daniel talks about four successive kingdoms. He calls three of them by name. The first one is Babylon. We see that in chapter 2, represented by Nebuchadnezzar. The second one he mentions over in chapter 8 and verse 12. Now, this is a different passage and different content in this passage, but still talking about a second kingdom, which is the kings of Media and Persia. And in fact, the Medo-Persian Empire followed the Babylonian Empire. And then if you read the next verse in Daniel chapter 8, verse 21, refers to a shaggy goat which represents the kingdom of Greece. And so, in fact, according to history, the Greek Empire with Alexander the Great, it followed the Medo-Persian Empire. And so you have three successive kingdoms: Babylon, the Persians, the Greeks. And then the fourth one, history informs us, is Rome. Now, Rome isn't called by name in the book of Daniel. So we draw upon events in history outside the Bible to inform our understanding of that fourth kingdom. But when you look at that, well then, look at that information, it's clear that the fourth one is Rome. History indicates that it's Rome. So here's the sequence. Cyrus of Persia defeated Babylon 539 B.C. Alexander the Great defeated Persia at Issus in 333 B.C. And then by the middle of the 2nd century B.C., Rome with its Caesars is in power. And so when Daniel talks about four kingdoms, and here in Daniel chapter 7, he talks about four kingdoms. He's talking about those four: Babylon, Persia, Greece, and then Rome. And so the fourth kingdom, represented by the beast that didn't look like the other beasts, that fourth kingdom is Rome. Do the rest of the details of the vision correspond to what happened in the days of Rome? And so that's an important question. The remaining details of the vision with the ten horns, the little horn, wearing out the saints, eventually that horn is defeated, a kingdom is given to the Son of Man and the saints and so forth. Do all those details correspond to events that took place during the Roman Empire? And that's why we've suggested that this fourth beast represents the Roman Empire. And during those days, all of these things will take place. Well, the answer, I think, is yes. Now, let's just talk about that for a minute or two. What about those ten kings represented by the ten horns? To what does that refer? Well, it's really difficult to identify with precision the ten kings represented by the ten horns. But Rome has a number of important and powerful kings which might be represented by these ten horns. Julius, if you want to count him as the first. Augustus, Caesar, Claudius, Tiberius, Nero, Trajan, Hadrian, Marcus Aurelius, Constantine. They had a lot of world emperors, didn't they? A lot of men that would correspond to these ten horns that grew up out of the head of the fourth beast. What about that little horn that wore down the saints? What about that horn? Is there anybody in the Roman Empire that corresponds to that description? A little horn that comes up and is small to begin with, but then its appearance becomes larger, it's very imposing. It dominates the situation. It wears out the saints. It speaks blasphemies against God. Is there any king in Roman history that would correspond to that? Well, again, it's difficult to choose just one, but there are several Roman emperors that fit that description. For example, there's Nero. He certainly persecuted the Christians. Domitian, Marcus Aurelius, Septimus Severus, Diocletian. So, yeah, it's hard to choose just one. There are several that really are represented, could be represented by a little horn, maybe small beginnings, but grows up, becomes very powerful, and blasphemes against God. Eventually, these Roman Caesars believed that they were God. So they blasphemed against God. They persecuted Christians. They wore out the saints. The Christians, were under the control of the Roman Empire for a period of time and so forth. And so, yeah, that fits very well. What we know from history fits very well with what we're reading here in Daniel chapter 7. And then what about this idea that the Son of Man, or one like unto a Son of Man, came to the Ancient of Days, and he was given a kingdom and dominion and so forth? Well, the fact is, as you know, Jesus of Nazareth was born and taught and died, was buried and raised, and ascended to God's right hand during the days of the Roman Empire. Jesus calls himself the Son of Man. And this passage, I believe, is in the background of that statement. When Jesus calls himself the Son of Man, he really is making a reference, although maybe a subtle reference, making a reference back to this passage. I am the Son of Man. I am the one that Daniel saw. I am the one who's going to receive a kingdom. And my authority and my dominion and my power will last from now on, and my kingdom. And if you want to rule, well, then you'll get with me. And we'll rule over all these worldly, powerful, but temporary kingdoms. The kingdom of God is established during the days of the Roman Empire. Remember Matthew chapter 4, Jesus says, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." And then in Acts chapter 2, we find Peter on the day of Pentecost talking about the death of Jesus and the resurrection of Jesus, how that was predicted in the Old Testament, the 16th Psalm. And so in verse 31, he says that David looked ahead, spoke of the resurrection of Christ. He was neither abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh suffer decay. This Jesus God raised up again, to which we are all witnesses. Therefore, having been exalted to the right hand of God, that's a position of rule and dominion and power, the right hand of God, having received from the Father the promise of the Holy Spirit, he's poured forth this which you see and hear. Therefore, let all the house of Israel know for certain that God has made him both Lord and Christ. He's the Lord. He's the King. He ascended to God's right hand. And all that takes place during the days of the Roman Empire. And so you see in Daniel chapter 7, I saw one like unto a Son of Man. He came before the Ancient of Days, was presented to him, and a kingdom and dominion and power was given to him. Well, that fits very well with what we know of Christ and his ascension and his place at God's right hand. All right, so Daniel, and then finally in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel speaks about this beast being defeated. We'll just black that out if we can. Finally, Daniel talks about this beast being defeated there at the end of the chapter. You remember he took the body, verses 11 and 12. The beast was killed, and its body then was given to the burning fire. Verse 26 says, the court will sit for judgment. His dominion will be taken away. The dominion of this beast and the horns and the little horn taken away and annihilated and destroyed forever. The sovereignty, the dominion, the greatness of all kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the highest one. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all the dominions of will serve and obey him. So Daniel speaks of the beast being defeated. Well, did that happen to Rome? Well, of course it did. By 425 at least, if not earlier, the Roman Empire was over. It had been defeated, never to rise again. Yet the church, God's kingdom, the kingdom given to the Son of Man, that was established in those days, it continues to exist. And we're part of it today. And so, yeah, the beast was overthrown. The beast was killed. The beast was destroyed. But the kingdom of the saints continues to exist and will thrive from now on, never be, to be destroyed. Well, let's make a couple of observations and make an application or two. First of all, we've already suggested that the Son of Man, that phrase that Jesus used to refer to himself so often, really has its background, I think, in this passage, Daniel chapter 7, when likened to a Son of Man. But dominion is given to him, that all nations and peoples and men of every language might serve him. And so we ought to serve Christ, that he is the King. He is the Lord. He is sitting on his throne. He is at the right hand of God. And so in Luke chapter 6 and verse 46, you'll remember that Jesus asked the question, why do you call me Lord and you don't do what I say? Now, why do we acknowledge him to be king? Why do we acknowledge him to be Lord if we're not going to follow what he says, if we're not going to obey him? In Matthew 28, there Jesus says, all authority has been given to me. If he has all authority, we must yield to his authority. We must bow to his authority. We must obey him. You remember the statement made in Philippians chapter 2. There, right at the end of the passage, God highly exalted him and bestowed on him a name that is above every name, that in the name of Jesus, every knee will bow. All right, he's on the throne. He's exalted. What does that mean? Every knee bows to Christ. We either bow to him now or we'll bow to him in judgment. We'll bow to him now, while we have the opportunity to live for him and to serve him and to be one of his disciples. Don't call him Lord and neglect to do the things that he says. John says in 1 John chapter 2 that we ought to walk in his steps. And so follow his example, walk in his steps. So all nations ought to serve him. Of course, there are a lot of people in the world who are not serving him, but all nations ought to serve him. Another lesson to be learned from this particular passage is that God, the God of Israel, is sovereign and controls all things. We've already seen that several times from the book of Daniel, but it's such a powerful lesson, we'll mention it again. Several times in the history of the Bible, in the Bible unfolding of the Bible story, God comes into direct conflict with the gods of the nations, with the gods of Egypt, or the gods of Canaan. Remember, Moses goes down into Egypt, and God sends the plagues upon the Egyptians, many of which correspond to the Egyptian gods themselves. And God is demonstrating his authority, his power over the gods of the Egyptians. Elijah, during the reign of Ahab, goes up into Mount Carmel, and God there is taking on the gods of the Canaanites, the Baal worshipers. And he shows himself to be the true God, the Lord. He is God. And so here, the struggle is between, in Daniel's day, God and Marduk, the gods of the Babylonians. The Babylonians would have thought their gods were greater than Israel's God because their gods had enabled them to defeat Israel and take them into captivity. But God shows his dominion and his power and his sovereignty through the vision of Daniel and says that these kings, all of these nations, are going to be brought down and replaced by others. Ultimately, all of them will be brought down. And the God of Israel will reign eternally. So Daniel saw the apparent defeat of God's people in the Babylonian captivity and in the days of the Roman Empire even, and then ultimately the victory of God's people. He knew that in his day this was not a defeat at all at the hands of the Babylonians, but a chastening for the infidelity of Israel to the covenant. God always wins. When he takes on other gods, God always wins. I think that was what Jeff Beavers told us the other night. God is undefeated. He always wins. In this passage, Daniel sees difficult days for God's people in the future, but he reassures us that God will ultimately vindicate his people and hold their oppressors responsible. God has always won. He will always win. And so we need to be on God's side We need to be on the side of the Son of Man, who's given dominion and kingdom and so forth. Well, that's good, I suppose, as far as it goes. And some may acknowledge God's control over the nations, which might affect us in some way. But what about a single individual's life? Is God concerned about us on that level? And we talk about God's control of the nations. He's raising nations up. He's bringing them down. But what about me? What about my life as an individual? Is God concerned about that? Is God in control of that? Or is God just in control and concerned about the big things in world affairs? Well, remember the teaching of Jesus. Jesus told his disciples, don't worry about what you're going to eat and what you're going to wear and what you're going to drink. God will take care of you. Look at the birds of the air, he says in Matthew 6, verse 26. They don't sow, they don't reap, they don't gather into barns, but your Father takes care of them. Don't worry about these things. Trust in God. He'll take care of you. In Matthew chapter 10, verses 28 through 30, there Jesus tells his disciples, even the very hairs of your head are numbered. Yeah, he's concerned about the big things in the world and international affairs and global events. He's concerned about you and you and you and me. Even the hairs of our head, he says, are numbered. Peter says, to cast our care upon him because he cares for us. In Philippians, Paul says, let your requests be made known to God. In Romans 10 and verse 13, Paul says, whoever calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. It gets right down to individual people, doesn't it? Whoever calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. Psalm 32 verse 6 says, let everyone who is godly pray to God. The mind of the man plans his ways, but the Lord directs his steps. And so all of those statements are directed to individual people. And so, yes, God acts on a global, international level, but also in the lives of each of his children. We can see that from the book of Daniel as well. God is called the God of Daniel. Not just the God of Israel, but the God of Daniel and the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. This particular message in Daniel chapter 7 talked about things that were going to take place in the future from Daniel's point of view. And so the message, in a sense, was not so much for Daniel's generation, but for those people who would read Daniel's book during the days of the little horn. They'd be well advised to be on God's side, to be faithful to him, even in troubled times, not to compromise, not to give up on their commitment to the Son of Man, who's ruling from God's right hand. We'd do well to learn this lesson ourselves. It may very well be that in the future, another little horn, so to speak, will rise up against the people of God and prevail against them for a time. It may well be that one of these days, even in our own nation, that the government will turn against us and that a little horn will rise up and wear out the saints for a while. We'd be well advised to be on the side of the God of Israel, to remain committed to and faithful to the Son of Man who received his kingdom from the Ancient of Days. In the book of 2 Timothy chapter 1, Jacob read this passage this morning. Paul says, I know whom I've believed. I'm convinced that he's able to guard what I've entrusted to him until that day. We need to have that same resolve. I know whom I've believed. I know he can guard what I've committed to him until that day. I know. Now, a little horn may come up. It may not. I don't know. But I know who I believed. And I know that he'll guard me until that day. I really think the more imminent danger for us is that danger posed by the world. I'm not really all that worried that somebody's going to come in here today and the government's going to turn against us and we're all going to be arrested. I don't think any of us are worried about that happening today. Now, that may happen sometime. But I really think the more imminent danger for you and for me is the danger that's posed by the world as it draws us away from God little by little, day after day. Our commitment is eroded. Our resolve is eroded. We become little by little more and more like the world in the things we say and the things we do, the places we go, all of those kind of things. That's the real danger for us. Take a stand. Be careful. Be firm. Endure the conflict. Yeah, there'll be conflict for us. Endure the conflict, because God will save us in the end. Well, difficult passage in some way. We haven't really talked about all, we have taken up every detail. We tried to make our way through Daniel chapter 7 and give a reasonable explanation of the things that are taught there. The message is conveyed in symbols and figures and visions, but the message is clear enough, isn't it? God will win. Get on His side. If you're here today and you're not on God's side, well then get on God's side. Become one of His children. And He will guard you and He'll fight your battles for you as long as you're faithful to Him. And in the end, you'll win. You become a child of God by putting your faith in Jesus as the Son of Man, as the Christ, repenting of your sin, being baptized that those sins might be forgiven, be washed away by the blood of Christ. Then you'll be a child of God. You may have become a child of God in the past, but you're not faithful to Him. You've gone back into sin. Repent. Confess those things. You'll be forgiven. And you can be on God's side once again and look forward to the ultimate eternal victory that He'll give to His saints through His Son. Can we help you this morning? If so, we invite you to come as we stand and sing together.